Welcome to the Telegram. I'm Tim Stanley. The bloody nightmare that is Syria continues, as both sides find themselves locked in negotiations to end a conflict that has taken an estimated 130,000 lives. We examine how we got to this point and what the secret of Assad's success is, including torture and foreign money. Also, a requiem for Claudio Abbado. Harry de Ketville leads a discussion about the life of one of the world's greatest ever conductors. I'm joined in the studio by the Telegraph's chief foreign correspondent David Blair, our defence editor Con Coughlan, by the Obits editor Harry de Ketville, blogs editor Damien Thompson, and by Ivan Hewitt, our esteemed music critic. You may recall that a few months ago the West said that there could be no peace in Syria until Bashar al-Assad stepped down. Now the game has subtly changed. Assad, it now feels, is going nowhere. And there can be no resolution to this brutal, barbaric conflict unless he is somehow involved. John Kerry, the US Secretary of State, has even countenanced talking to the Iranians. It all begs the question, how has Assad done it? When the Arab Spring happened, other regimes crumbled to dust, but he has hung on by his bloody fingertips. The secret of his success is a mix of ruthlessness and foreign money. Earlier, I spoke with David Blair, who gave us some of the benefits of his insight before flying off to Ukraine to report on the horrors happening there. I spoke to him about Assad's incredible staying power. David Blair, what exactly is the situation on the ground in Syria at the moment?
In the last few months, the regime has made quite a lot of military advances. They've essentially secured large areas of Damascus, although not all of it. They've secured Latakia and the Alawite heartland on the Mediterranean coast, and they've grabbed most of the territory in between. So that's a military victory for Bashar, but you have to put it in context. He's only here in control of about a third of Syria. He's written off the other two-thirds of Syria. In fact, he's not even trying to reconquer most of those areas. So he might call himself the president of Syria, but given that he doesn't control most of his country, you might question whether that's actually a real label.
What's the advantage to him for that? Why is that the goal that he set for himself? I mean, it does seem rather pathetic.
It's probably the most he can achieve, given the forces at his disposal. I don't think he's got the power to reconquer the two-thirds of Syria that have slipped out of his grasp during the course of the last 2 years.
So does he see himself clinging on for life as the president of just a third of his country?
As long as it allows him to call himself president of Syria, then he'll define that as a victory. One thing about dictators is that they set the bar for victory very low. You might remember that Saddam Hussein in 1991 convinced himself that he'd won the Gulf War, the one where he was chucked out of Kuwait,
right.
Because at the end of the fighting, he was still in Baghdad, and he was still able to call himself president of Iraq, and he was still alive.
Right.
So in his terms, that was a victory. And you sense something of the same with Bashar. For as long as he's in his capital, in his presidential palace, able to call himself the president of Syria, in his mind, that amounts to a victory.
So it's a sort of psychological victory rather than necessarily a material one. And is that part of the international community recognizing him? Is that an important part of his sense of accomplishment?
Yes. He wants to be able to say, look, you might have deprived me of control over most of my country, but you can't actually dislodge me in
right.
the end.
Okay. Okay. Now, it was the case previously that the Western powers were calling for his total removal. Now that seems to be less certain. What's the changing narrative going on there, and why is it altered?
I think you have a sense of stalemate. In the end, it all comes down to the balance of forces on the ground. Bashar, bolstered as he has been by Iran and by Russia, has got enough force to hold on to what he currently has. And the opposition, equally, are not going to be dislodged from the areas they control. So you have a sense of stalemate. And I think the international community has realized that Bashar militarily is not going to be driven from office, even though his conception of what being in office is, as we've just discussed, is pretty limited.
But that hasn't changed, even though we've had these reports of torture. I mean, has that not affected the way the West sees it? Is it going to continue to say he should be part of the process, despite what we now know?
Well, the revulsion towards Bashar is greater now than it has ever been, I suspect, very largely because of the release of these photographs. But the reality is that militarily, his opponents don't seem to have the power to dislodge him.
Where is the opposition coming from, and what role has Assad himself played in fueling this conflict?
Well, the most powerful elements of the opposition now are religious extremists. And that allows Bashar to say, look, the choice is very simple. It's between me or al-Qaeda. You may not like me, but you don't want al-Qaeda running Syria either. So I'm the lesser of the two evils. That's the narrative which has sprung up.
And it didn't start that way, just to be absolutely clear.
It didn't begin that way. At the beginning, the opposition was a very disparate group of people who probably didn't primarily have a religious agenda at all. They had a political agenda. They wanted to be rid of Bashar. Now, what happened was, as the conflict went on, al-Qaeda saw its opportunity. It saw its opportunity to get involved in a revolution of the Arab Spring, having had no role at all in the Egyptian or the Tunisian or the Libyan revolutions. They realized that they really had to get involved in Syria or they would lose any relevance at all. So that became their main effort. And it's in the nature of conflicts in the Middle East, in a Sunni majority state, that the longer a civil war goes on, the more likely it is that the virus, if you like, of al-Qaeda's brand of extremism is going to take hold.
And it went on so long because Assad fought back.
It went on so long because he was rescued by his outside allies,
right,
principally Iran, who rescued him in a very direct way by sending the Revolutionary Guard and most particularly Hezbollah to fight alongside him. So he was rescued. And if we look back, there was a moment in the summer of 2012 when he was right on the edge of the precipice. He could have gone at any moment in the summer of 2012 when the rebels were penetrating into the heart of Damascus, when they carried out an astonishingly audacious attack where they killed three of the six men at the apex of the regime with a single bombing. Now, he was pulled back from the brink because at that moment, Iran and Hezbollah weighed in on his support.
Which has got to help him in terms of this narrative of saying it's me against the religious extremists.
That's right. And we need to be careful about that narrative because it is true that al-Qaeda has assumed a very powerful, perhaps even the leading role in the Syrian opposition. But it's done that very largely because Bashar has engineered it. He released a very large number of prisoners from his jails who were religious extremists. And some of the people he released have gone on to assume leadership roles in the al-Qaeda organization in Syria today. And secondly, we know that al-Qaeda is able to export oil from some of the areas of Syria that it controls. And it so happens that some of those oil exports go through government-controlled areas. So it seems that he's actually collaborating with them in order to arrange for them to be funded. This has been reported in the Daily Telegraph, actually, in the last few days. So this narrative that has grown up is very largely Bashar's construction, and it's a very deliberate effort to present us with the impossible choice. You may not like me, but what about al-Qaeda?
Given that he could have fallen, given that that's what happened in most of the rest of the region when the Arab Spring occurred, is it fair to say he's cleverer than the average Middle East dictator?
No, he's more ruthless and he's less constrained.
Right.
If you're Mubarak facing the crowds in Tahrir Square in 2011, you've got a very big problem. There's a limit to what you can do. You can't organize a Tiananmen Square in Tahrir Square. You can't do it for two reasons. One, Egypt at that time was completely open to the media. You would have ended up staging your Tiananmen live on CNN and the BBC. And secondly, Mubarak was a Western ally, and the Americans made it very clear that they weren't going to stand for that kind of thing. So there was a limit to the ruthlessness that leaders like Ben Ali in Tunisia or Mubarak in Egypt could employ. With Bashar, those constraints don't apply.
Right.
His allies are the likes of Iran and Russia. They have no qualms about the methods that he's using. Syria has, at best, sporadic access to the international media, so he can close down access when he needs to, and he can get on with very bad things without anyone noticing.
David Blair, thank you very much. So with David Blair, I talked about how Assad has held on so long. Let's now talk about the role of foreign powers in Syria. Con Coughlin, tell me all about the different players and how they've got themselves stuck into this conflict.
Well, when I look at the Syrian conflict, remember I started my career covering the Lebanese civil war in the 1980s. One of the reasons that this conflict has lasted so long and has become so violent is that, like the Lebanese civil war in the 1970s and 1980s, it has been sustained by the involvement of various foreign powers. Now, on the Assad side, for the Assad regime, you've got very powerful backers. You've got Iran's Revolutionary Guards, and you've got the Russians, who are providing quite sophisticated weaponry, particularly air defence missiles and things like that, which, of course, have made the West think twice about getting involved militarily. And on the rebel side, you have a potpourri of countries, really, which makes it very confusing. The sort of moderate Islamic countries are supporting the moderate Syrian opposition. But then you've got countries like Saudi Arabia and Qatar, which are giving funds to the more Islamist groups, such as the Nusra Front. And then, of course, you've got al-Qaeda waiting in the wings. And al-Qaeda is its own international movement. Add to that mix the CIA and British intelligence, the Foreign Office, supporting elements within the moderate opposition, training them, giving them sort of low-level weaponry. And you can see that we have a recipe here for a war that, unless Geneva is successful, could last for many years to come.
What is the strategic interest of, say, Iran in Syria? Why have they come to the aid of a country that's quite far away, that isn't a theocratic government in the way that they are? Why have they got involved?
Well, Tim, in one word, Hezbollah. If you look at the history of the Iranian Revolution over the last 30-odd years, the one significant foreign policy success that the Islamic Revolution has achieved has been to establish Hezbollah among the Shia community of southern Lebanon. Not only does this allow them to control and influence a very sizable Shia population in the Arab world, it also gives them a front line against Israel. And of course, in the past, Hezbollah has had various conflicts with Israel. And this is vital to the sustainability of the Islamic Revolution. It's very much part of the revolution's narrative that they have Hezbollah. Of course, they've tried to do a similar thing among the Shia community in southern Iraq. A lot of the Shias in southern Lebanon are closely linked. They have close family ties to the Shias of southern Iraq. So this is vitally important. And where does Syria fit into this? Well, for its own reasons, and this goes back to the rivalry between Assad and Saddam Hussein in the 80s and 90s, the Assad regime has tilted towards Iran, and basically because of its dislike of the old Iraqi regime, and has supported Iran and facilitated Iran, setting up Hezbollah, supplying arms to Hezbollah, and allowing the Revolutionary Guards to travel freely between southern Lebanon and Tehran.
Does Iran believe it is assisting a sort of within the Muslim world global revolution here, or is it simply a form of cynical statecraft?
There's a bit of that, but again, you have to add to this, Tim, the whole Sunni-Shia conflict that is this whole fault line that has emerged really since the Arab uprisings first started 3 years ago. And this all has to do with the relationship between Saudi Arabia and Iran. They've never got on ever since the Ayatollahs came to power in 1979. The Saudis, with their very, very hardline Wahhabi Sunni tradition, do not like what the Ayatollahs have done with Shia Islam. And these tensions have really sort of now come to the fore. The Saudis are worried about Iran's nuclear program. They want to get rid of Assad. They've got history with Assad. And the Iranians have basically piled into Damascus. Over the last 2 years, the Revolutionary Guards, I think, have sent about 300 of their top officials to train the Shabab, to get Assad's fighters up to speed. And when you look at the history of the conflict, the turning point really in the revival of Assad's fortunes, which I've written for The Telegraph, was when the Iranians arrived in Damascus.
Okay. Now, the Iranians have a new president. Rouhani has said he wants to engage with the rest of the world. John Kerry has said that Iran may play some role in the peace process. Do you believe this?
Well, John Kerry is right to say that part of the solution to the Syrian crisis lies in Tehran as much as Damascus. The problem is the Iranians have made it very clear that they do not accept the protocols laid down in the first Geneva conference, which was that basically there should be a ceasefire, the establishment of a transition government, which in which Assad himself could play no role. Well, the Iranians don't accept that. They categorically reject it, mm-hmm. which is why they had to be disinvited to Geneva too. And so long as the Iranians insist that Assad will survive, it's very hard to see how they can be constructive in the current process.
Okay. And final question. Throughout all of this, what has been the West's single biggest mistake? What did it not do that it should have done, or what did it do that it shouldn't have done?
I think the West's biggest mistake was not to think through the challenges the initial unrest posed and to formulate a clear strategy. The problem is we've changed our minds. One minute it's Assad must go, the next we must deal with the humanitarian crisis, then it's we must arm the rebels. And we've been shilly-shallying around this issue for the last 3 years. I support Senator John McCain's argument that at the start of this conflict, because of our standoff with Iran, there was a very good strategic reason for getting rid of the Assad regime militarily. There was a window to do that at the start. But we've missed that. There is no longer that window, and we're left struggling now, trying to curry favour with the Russians to get a deal, a ceasefire deal. And my prognosis is that this conflict will end with Assad in power and the West looking far weaker.
Con Coughlin, thank you very much.
Pleasure, Tim.
The death of Claudio Bardo marks the end of an era for classical music. A diffident, cool-tempered Italian from a Milanese cultural dynasty, his death has robbed the world of one of its most significant musical figures, and one of its most enigmatic. To lead our discussion on why he was so beloved, I'm going to hand over to Harry de Ketville, the Telegraph Obituaries editor. Harry will soon be launching a new Obits podcast, and, to give you a flavour, he's joined by Damien Thompson and by Ivan Hewitt to talk about the late, great Claudio Bardo. Harry.
Thank you, Tim. Welcome, everybody, to this, the first in what we hope will be a regular series of Obits podcasts. We plan to round up the extraordinary events and achievements of the lives that we have featured in the obituaries column before settling down to focus, as Tim said, on the life and work of one man or woman who has particularly caught the eye. A quick recap, then, about this week. This was the week in which Haru Onoda died, the Japanese soldier who hid in the jungles of the Philippines for 30 years, refusing to accept that the Second World War was over. We also covered the remarkable life of Chuck Smith, pastor to the Summer of Love hippies on America's West Coast. He was the man who got tens of thousands of dropouts to turn on and tune in to God. We shouldn't, of course, forget Roger Lloyd Pack, the actor who became famous as Trigger in Only Fools and Horses, or Charles Grigg, the cartoonist famous for drawing Corky the Cat in the pages of The Dandy. No doubt we could have run the whole podcast on a nostalgic theme of whether The Dandy or The Beano was truly the best comic to grow up with. But instead, we're going to focus, as Tim said, on Claudio Abbado, the remarkable Italian conductor who was maestro at La Scala, the Vienna State Opera, the LSO, and perhaps the most celebrated post in world music, the Berlin Philharmonic. With me here is Ivan Hewitt and Damien Thompson. Ivan, if I can start with you, how high do you think Abbado ranks in the charts of the really great 20th century conductors?
Oh, very high, I would say. He was an extraordinary figure. It is hard to think of anyone quite like him in the way that he was able to conjure great results in a way that was deeply mysterious. You could sit in on a rehearsal of Claudio's and not really see how he was doing it, because he said very little. In fact, he would play certain sections again, and he would gesture towards certain musicians, and he had this meaning way of looking at people. He often said his greatest tool was his eyes, in fact.
And he would instruct his musicians to just listen, rather enigmatic instruction.
He would, and this made some people slightly sceptical about him. But the proof of the pudding in the end was always in the eating, and the results were really, really astounding. I mean, during his time at the Berlin Philharmonic, he could at times make the players despair a little, actually. He was the least efficient rehearsal of an orchestra.
How do you mean?
Well, in the sense that he didn't do what seems to be number one on any conductor's to-do list, as it were, which is organize your rehearsal time really carefully, you know,
right.
So that, you know, on the hour you start at this bar and at 15 minutes past you turn to this section. So
right, it's clear
he wouldn't do that.
He wanted sort of all the time in the world to rehearse.
He did. And, of course, Berlin was one of the few places you could get it.
Mm.
Maybe one of the reasons he didn't work very much latterly in this country was that, you know, rehearsal time here is always rather short.
Mm. And if I can bring in Damien as well, you can both talk about this. What do you think the repertoire was in which he truly excelled?
People often say that Abbado brought a mixture of North Italian coolness, but distinctively Italian spirit to the Viennese and German tradition, which is a way of saying that he was very good at crossing musical frontiers and very good at interpreting composers who were, if you like, polyglots. I think if you had to single out one composer, it ought to be Mahler, who was a composer who drew on many different traditions and who spoke many different musical languages while always being absolutely recognizably Mahler. And I think particularly of live recording of Mahler's Ninth, in which the ending seems stretched out to infinity but is not self-indulgent or boring, and is... There's an underlying intelligence. It's very difficult to anatomize that, but with all of Claudio Abbado's recordings, and I've heard him once or twice in the concert hall, the sense that you were dealing with a man who was both passionate and an intellectual communicated itself in the playing.
I mean, one always imagines that Italian conductors are going to concentrate on the great Italian composers, but the truly great global conductors always seem to come back to Mahler. Is that something that was true? I mean, he presents huge challenges, Mahler.
He presents huge challenges. I mean, a sceptic would say he also presents huge opportunities for a certain sort of emotional display, let's say. You know, in a Mahler symphony, the conductor is guiding the audience as much as the orchestra, often, you know, by their gestures and their, you know, their facial expressions, they help the audience to perceive the direction of the music. Mahler's symphonies do tend to be a test case for conductors. Also, he works in these colossal time frames. You know, the finale of the Sixth Symphony is sort of 35 minutes or something.
Mm.
You know? And to control a span of that length is an extraordinary test.
Were there other composers you think that he particularly excelled at interpreting?
Well, he did have a great strength in contemporary music, actually. We shouldn't forget that. In his youth, he was associated with that socialist firebrand, Luigi Nono, you know, and worked a lot with him, conducted several of his pieces. He worked with Stockhausen more than once. If I was to name other composers particularly, I would think of... similar to Mahler, really, the those expressionist composers who came just a little later, where a similar language is turned to even more febrile, intense effects. I'm thinking of works of Schoenberg and Alban Berg, around about 1908, 1910 sort of period. He was brilliant at those, just wonderful.
Late in his life, he suffered stomach cancer, and he recovered. And from this brush with death, observers, listeners said that he brought a new spirituality to his music, which I've noticed is a common theme. After von Karajan had this spinal surgery, people said he had the same, came back with this new focus. Is that possible? Do people's characters change? Can you detect that in the music, Ivan?
It's a difficult one, that, isn't it? And it's something one would like to believe, in a way. Certainly, when you compare the photographs, there's a very striking change of appearance in the man, you know? He seems etherealized somehow.
Yes, it's really quite shocking. I remember reading somebody on the internet saying they divided Abbado's career into three sections, pre-cancer, cancer, when he was suffering and it made life very difficult for him in Berlin, and post-cancer, when he was working with the Lucerne Festival Orchestra and the Mahler Youth Orchestra and producing such extraordinary beauty, intelligence, mellowness. But perhaps this is something that comes with experience, and it is not necessarily to undergo tremendous physical suffering. I mean, I sometimes hear in the last recordings of Alfred Brendel, who, so far as I know, hasn't been through that sort of ordeal, a mellowness and a spontaneity that just comes with age.
Hmm. I mean, certain conductors, it seems to be a theme that comes back, are overwhelmed with questions of their own mortality. I noticed that Colin Davis kept a skeleton in his own home, I think, and he said that he thought about death every day. To many casual listeners, classical music can seem like the most uplifting, transcendent occupation. But do great artists, are they like conductors, like all great artists, perhaps surrounded by the great questions of life and death?
Well, I suppose conductors are super aware of transience, just because they're dealing in an art form which, where you're shaping a modest span of time, you know, and in a sense, what you're doing, actually, one way of defining the art, I suppose, is to say that you're shaping something that is that leads in exactly the right inevitable way to an extinction.
Mm.
You're sort of shaping a life history, if you like, of a piece. So perhaps that does account for it.
And if I hope this doesn't seem like a facetious thing to say, but one or two conductors have actually died on the podium, haven't they? Or Sinopoli, I think.
He did indeed, yes. Indeed. And one or two others have come to grief on the podium. You know, it seems to be a rather dangerous place to be.
If we can just talk about the general business of conducting, Abbado was clearly a great conductor, but in our obituary of Karajan, we noted that his interpretations were distinguished by line and structure, beauty of sound, rhythmic precision, and a wide range of dynamic. When you read that, it seems almost as though he was writing the piece as well as conducting. Do conductors really have the power to so supremely shape what someone else has actually composed?
Well, I was talking to the now recently appointed chief conductor of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, Sakari Oromo, on this topic, and he said that when he conducts, when things are going well, he does feel like he's improvising. You know, but wow. A number of things have to come together for that to work. You know, at the other extreme, when things fall out of kilter between the orchestra and the conductor, then you're into a rather different situation, which Esa-Pekka Salonen, another one of these great Finnish conductors, described as rather like trying to control a car on ice. You know, what you shouldn't do is fight the wheel too much. You have to let go and allow things to come back together again. But you know, when luck is on your side, and I think there is a fair amount of luck involved, actually, when you've got 60 or 70 people there, then a kind of freedom does come into the process where you can play about with the tempo, surprise people. And interestingly, this can happen with those conductors who one tends to think of as somehow possibly a little cerebral and cold. I'm thinking of Pierre Boulez, who is famous, or maybe I should say notorious, among players for surprising them in performance.
It is one of the great unpredictable relationships, isn't it, between a conductor and his orchestra, Damien, that you have one man or woman trying to shape the destinies of 60 or 70 players,
yes,
and
indeed.
It can be a tremendous success
indeed.
Or a horrible car
indeed.
Crash.
I mean, I used to know a concert pianist who said that he always had very, very warm relations generally with the orchestras when he was playing a Beethoven piano concerto, but tried his hand at conducting, and immediately it was a different relationship. They were no longer his friends. They were no longer on his side. He had to win them over in a way that he didn't have to as a soloist. The risks are very great, in particular in certain works, these epic symphonies. Let's take the example of Bruckner. If the conductor doesn't know what he's doing, if he lets the souffle sag, then, shall we say, their failure is far more audible than any success they might achieve. And I think I'm right in saying that that sort of misadventure almost never happened to Claudio Abbado.
Fantastic. Just our final point, that great conductors used to be thought of as rather tyrannical figures, and I wonder whether that's still the same today. In our obituary of the wonderful but wayward conductor Wynne Morris, we noted that in the late 20th century, a conductor succeeded by working in established orchestras with programmes and priorities chosen as much for political as professional reasons. Where Toscanini could be a tyrant, Morris had to behave, and his tragedy was that with all his remarkable talents, he could not or would not conform. Do conductors, Ivan, have to conform now? Is the day of the tyrant over? Will we never see the likes of Toscanini or von Karajan again?
Well, I mean, just to add to that list of names, George Sell, who conducted the Cleveland Orchestra, was famous for putting the fear of God into the players. And there was a famous occasion when he praised them. And they were so astonished that they burst into applause. And then he turned to them and said, well, not that good. just that they wouldn't, their enthusiasm wouldn't go overboard. I think it does depend on the level of the orchestra you're dealing with, because I suppose one shouldn't forget that from a certain date, Abbado was dealing with only the highest level orchestras, several of them hand-picked. So the whole business of things like discipline never arose for him. For many conductors, it does arise in quite a severe way, you know. And although it seems to be de rigueur now for any conductor when interviewed on this topic to say, oh, of course, you know, we can't tyrannize anymore, we have to be democratic. The fact is that he or she, in the end, is the boss, actually, and probably has only 3-hour rehearsal to get a rather difficult program together. And so has to be quite strict at times. And I think, in fact, orchestras do actually like to be worked. I've encountered orchestral players who get a little restive under a very laissez-faire conductor because they feel they're rather like thoroughbred horses. You know, they want to be really trained so that they can really give it the
best. It's clear that Abbado, although a shy and introspective man, was no wallflower. I mean, he got his way.
And, of course, one shouldn't forget, also, he was, in a way, a kind of entrepreneur. I mean, I suppose alongside Thomas Beecham, he was the great creator of orchestras of the century, really. You know, there's the Lucerne Academy Orchestra, you know, made up of young players, the Gustav Mahler Jugend Orchestra, and most recently the Orchestra Mozart, based in Bologna. You know, all his creations.
Well, thank you, Ivan. Thank you, Damien. And thank you, everyone, for listening. Don't forget that if you want to contact us, you can on Twitter at @TelegraphObits. I'm @HarryDeCue. All the obits mentioned today are on our website. Thank you, everyone, for listening.